This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from Jerry Lane Chevrolet and from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Robin Dow is producing, and our leadoff guest is Elbert Guillory, who served a decade in the Louisiana legislature as a state House member and a state senator, most of the time as a state senator. And he is here to talk about the issues of the day, and he does so as a person of rank in the Republican fold. He is a former Democrat, but he is head of minority outreach for the Louisiana GOP, and Elbert Guillory is planning on running for lieutenant governor next year. But this year we have an election, and tomorrow qualifying begins. And there is a person in the Navy, Luke Mixon, who is running as a Democrat. Elbert Guillory is a Navy veteran, Vietnam, and in the race also expected to qualify, Gary Chambers and the incumbent, John Neely Kennedy. Senator Guillory, your thoughts about the U.S. Senate race that is in the offing?
I think that there won't really be a race. Kennedy has the name recognition. He has the $18 million in his
I think it's up to campaign I think it's coffers. Up to 28, by the way, $28 million.
Wow. that's not going to be a serious race. I don't believe that there'll be a runoff. I think that he will run, that he'll take at least 60% of the vote handily at the very outset in the primary.
Well, unless he gets a Republican challenger, and there were some rumblings, but I think any Republican will have to think about going against a guy who's an incumbent with $28 million. So probably will not happen, but there's always that possibility. And John Kennedy is a person who some Republicans don't trust. He was a liberal Democrat for many years. He was the guy who advised Buddy Romer to veto those two abortion bills in 1990 when he was Romer's counsel. He ran as a liberal Democrat in 2004 for the U.S. Senate against David Bitter. And he had an epiphany, and it's working for him, Elbert Guillory. It's working real well for him as far as elections go.
It has. It is true. He once was lost, but he is now found.
Now he is found.
is operating on the national scene. He really enjoys the national spotlight, and the national media is very kind to him. Of course, he earns it with those very pithy sayings and responses of his. So I think that he's a shoo-in. No contest.
Well, both Mixon and Chambers, in their own way, are good candidates. They will get some votes, but as we know, in a statewide election, Democrats are not playing a great hand, and you've got two up-and-coming Democrats who are basically vying for 40% of the votes. So that doesn't compute unless there's a Republican who gets in the race, and there may be a minor Republican or two, but the question is whether somebody who has the ability to raise funds and to have some name recognition would get in against John Kennedy. There was some talk that Tony Spell might, but I have my doubts. I think the Reverend will probably keep on doing what he's doing, and it's working pretty well for him from the pulpit, so we shall see. And in the congressional races, I was surprised that the money on hand, the guy who I guess represents you, Elbert Guillory, Clay Higgins, has very little money on hand. He, of course, has great popularity in Acadiana, but he has his detractors as well. Do you think he will draw a viable opponent?
I don't think that he will draw a viable opponent. We've been searching Acadiana to see who might be interested in running against him. Not in order to encourage them, but just as an intellectual exercise. He has recently been, I think within the last 24 hours, been endorsed by the Louisiana GOP. So I don't think that any Republican person will contest. There may be a very, very minor Democrat candidate out there, but he too, Clay, will win handily, I believe.
All right, and Elbert Guillory is speaking as a Republican. Today, in a listener, this is Hal in Monroe, says, ask him about Paul Krugman's column in the New York Times, and I just pulled it up. Texas is often hot, but not like this. Current forecasts have the temperature in Dallas hitting 109 degrees today, with highs in triple digits well into next week. Britain, on the other hand, used to have a well-deserved reputation as a cool, rainy island, but as I write, the temperature in London is projected to hit 102 degrees today. Do we have global warming, and are we doing the right things about it, Elbert Guillory?
I think that over the last 2 or 3 million years, the climate has changed backwards and forwards. There's been an ice age. There have been major droughts. I don't think that this is a serious departure in Mother Nature's behavior. But what we're not doing right about it is that we're permitting this global energy crisis to keep people from turning on their air conditioning units here and in Britain. The cost of oil and natural gas, which was quite cheap recently, is causing major problems to the world in heating and cooling.
Well, that is true, but are we doing the right things to address climate change?
I think that we are. We've taken leadership in the world, our nation has, with respect to cutting back emissions. We are taking steps, and these steps should be moderate and balanced and common sense steps, and many of them have gone a little bit afar, but if we can continue what we're doing, I think that we will prevent any kind of major disaster, and things are going to cool off when God's ready to cool them off.
So you're counting on God, but some people say Jesus helps those who help themselves, and right now we're not doing much about it. So we're playing with fire, literally.
Well, we're doing some nutty things instead of some common sense things, trying to get rid of all of America's automobiles, destroying the oil and gas industries, natural gas, sending natural gas prices soaring, gasoline prices, diesel prices soaring, and those soaring prices will end tomorrow. We won't have a tomorrow. People won't be able to survive today.
Well, people can walk, and as I look around, some people might benefit from a good walk.
Well, we are between a rock and a hard place.
You're a fit guy. Do you calculate your steps, Elbert Guillory?
Your
phone can do it, some people have watches. So how many steps are you averaging?
I don't know, but my son put one of those watches on me, and it broke. I took too many steps for it on the first day. So.
Well, my friend Mark Calvert showed me about a year ago that I could do this on my phone, and I've become obsessed with it. I am averaging 17,558 steps per day for this year. So, Elbert Guillory, can you beat me? Let's race.
All right. I'll put one of those watches on.
So you know what? I'm not driving as much. We don't need these gas-guzzling cars as much as we think we do. Rose on Florida Boulevard. Rose, you're on with Senator Guillory. Good morning, Rose.
Good morning, Senator Guillory. Good morning, Jim. Thank you for taking my call. You know, there's alternatives to the gas. It's just that there's a whole lot of people getting rich off gas that don't want to switch to electric, which will save our planet, not just us, everybody. So what do you say about that? Do you want to save all of us or none of us?
Good morning, Rose. I would like to save all of us. I think that a balanced approach, we can't just do it overnight. We can't do it within 10 years. We cannot destroy oil and gas in 10 years and survive. It will not work.
Well, maybe there's a way to do it. Maybe not in 10 years. I don't even think the oil, what was it, 2035 is the target date to get rid of the gas-guzzling cars. So that's 13 years. Maybe that's a target we can do, but we got to do something. I don't think there's any doubt that this is something that is going to be existential, and we're feeling it now, and it's only going to get worse unless we do something. But yet, Joe Biden, who, of course, is in favor of some of these clean air initiatives, a lot of them, he can't get them through Congress, mainly because of a senator in West Virginia named Joe Manchin, 74 years young. We'll talk more about it with Elbert Lee Guillory after this 90-second pause on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. And a few moments ago with Elbert Guillory, we're talking about Clay Higgins, and lo and behold, Greg Hilburn, the exceptional reporter from North Louisiana, writes, surprise Republican candidate Holden Hoggett will challenge U.S. Representative Clay Higgins in Louisiana's 3rd Congressional District race. Hoggett is 42, a Lafayette prosecutor who operates his own practices. He raises cattle. He's a member of the National Rifle Association, the Delta Waterfowl Association, and the American Quarter Horse Association. 42 years old. He is a Republican. I met this gentleman. And Clay Higgins, who I guess has been taking the race for granted, only has $258,000 cash on hand. This guy Hoggett may be a serious challenger, Elbert Guillory.
Wow. That is a surprise. I know Mr. Hoggett, and I think that he will make a very fine candidate. I still believe that Clay Higgins has the name recognition and the experience. He will win. Although I believe that Holden will give him a battle.
And if you get a Democrat in there, we could have a runoff. So it could be a real interesting scenario now in this district. And of course, Clay Higgins, as I stated, he's a cult hero with a lot of people. But there are others who say, look, Lafayette's now an urbane, sophisticated city, and we don't think Clay Higgins is the right guy to represent us. Is that fair, or am I I'm being unfair? What do you think about that sentiment by some regarding Congressman Higgins?
I think that's fair, but I think that they're in a significant minority in Acadiana. Acadiana has supported Clay over and over and for many years, and he's a hero. In Acadiana, he's larger than a big statue. Jim, if I may, just one thing. We spoke with Ms. Rose a few moments ago. I wanted her to know that I do have solar panels on my home and on my office, and I drive a fuel-efficient Honda.
All right, James in Metairie. James, you're on with Senator Guillory. Hi, James. What's your question?
Good morning to you, Jim. Good morning, Mr. Guillory. Sir, about 10 years ago, you testified before the Louisiana legislature, the Louisiana Science Education Act, in which you described an encounter that you had with a witch doctor, saying, you know, oh, faith healing is possibly good, and there's some bones on the ground and whatnot. Sir, that's witchcraft.
All right, well, what is your question?
Advocating...
Okay, go ahead.
Is he advocating witchcraft, and he's a born-again witch doctor?
All right, that's maybe some hyperbole there, but you're laughing. What do you say to James in Metairie?
The Lord has blessed me to be able to travel to many places and to work with people who are, and meet many people who are in many different cultures. The man was a healer. He was not a witch doctor. This was not witchcraft. This was a traditional medicine man, and he was plying his trade and had done so successfully. He was also a godly man, not necessarily a practitioner of Christianity or Islam or Judaism, but a very godly person.
877-217-5757 to get in under the wire with Albert Lee Guillory. David in Atlanta. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Guillory, after the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers ransacked the Capitol, maimed and attacked and physically brutalized police officers, defecated in
offices. What's your question, David?
Well, my question is, how did you feel, Mr. Guillory, when the President, Donald Trump, said he'd love them and they were special? Were you as ashamed?
All right. What about the 1-6 Commission and President Trump's culpability? Is he going to be indicted? What do you think?
I don't think that he's going to be indicted. I believe that there were some people who went overboard on that day, and I believe that the justice system will bring them to justice. I do not like law breaking of any kind by any person from the far right, the far left, anyone else. I condemned the burning of America's cities a couple of years ago, just as viciously as I condemn any law breaking. It's not proper.
Here's a story from Sam Carlin in today's Advocate, and it's the big story. Lawyers debate clarity of state's abortion ban. Lawyers for abortion providers in our state told a judge, Don Johnson, yesterday that the state's strict ban on the procedure is rife with ambiguity and is hurting pregnant women by causing doctors to delay certain types of medical care out of fear they'll wind up in prison. Attorney General Jeff Landry's attorneys, who are defending the ban, countered that the law is plenty clear. Elective abortions are banned, and doctors won't be in violation of the criminal laws as long as they use reasonable medical judgment. Landry says those people who don't like it have two choices. They can go and try to change the law. If they find themselves in the minority of ideas, they can pack their bags and go somewhere else. Your response, Senator Albert Lee Guillory.
I think that abortion, you know, Jim, started 50 years ago. The laws were changed. There was a small, I remember around 250. This was a small medical procedure that was reasonable and necessary. It morphed into more than a million abortions per year. And that morphing, that change from a ripple to a tsunami really is what hurt America and what has caused this total ban in some states on abortion today. It still needs to be balanced, but we need to take into consideration that the abortion mills of Planned Parenthood were set in minority communities across this country so that 750,000 babies per year, black and brown babies, would be destroyed. The Klan.
All right. Well, you're really getting into some interesting territory. But abortions really are about 600,000 in the U.S. They have gone down in the United States, and you are right that in the South there are more women of color who get abortions than other women. And nationwide, I think it's in the high 30% for a population that's 13%. So a disproportionate number of black people. But some people would say that's because of economic conditions. But Trish and Grand Coteau, you're on. Trish, you're on with Senator Guillory. Please be brief. No, we lost Trish. Let's try Carl calling in St. Martinville. Carl in St. Martinville, you're on with Senator Guillory. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning. I have a question for Mr. Guillory. If you're faced with a decision or a choice, which one would you follow? The first 10 commandments or the 11th?
What are you talking about, the 11th commandment?
You're not familiar with the 11th commandment?
I know what Ronald Reagan said the 11th commandment was, but what are you...
That's the one I'm referring to.
All right. I shall not speak ill of a fellow Republican. Is that it? So, Albert Guillory, is that something in your mantra?
I'm a Christian. I believe in the 10 commandments, and I will speak ill, as I have always, of any politician who deserves it.
All right. Well, on this show many times, Senator Guillory has stated that he is actively seeking a new Mrs. Guillory. He's single now. And a man of your vintage, in fact, you're exactly the same age, John Ilario, has found 43-year-old Trina Edwards. Are you pleased that your former colleague, the established and iconic John Ilario, has found love with the widow of Edwin Washington Edwards?
I love a good love story, and I am ecstatic, very, very happy that Senator Ilario and Mrs. Edwards have found love. Yes, he is 78. She's in her early 40s, and this is it's fabulous. I think it's a love made in heaven.
And he's a Republican. She's a Democrat. This is a bipartisan relationship. And as B.J. Thomas said so eloquently, even the bad love is better than no love at all. Thank you, Senator Guillory. Keep going. We'll talk soon. Always a pleasure. And we'll be back.
With this is mine, sir. Thank you.
Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Always a pleasure to catch up with Dennis Dale McLean, the last man to win 30 games in a major league season, 31-6 in the year of 1968, 53 years ago, 54 years ago. And in 1966, when he was a lad of 22, he started in the All-Star game for the American League at Busch Stadium, and his opponent was 30-year-old Sandy Koufax in his last and greatest season. Koufax went 27-9 in 66. McLean was a 20-game winner for the Detroit Tigers. And in three innings, Denny McLean allowed no hits, no walks, struck out three. Koufax allowed one run and struck out one. So on that day, Denny McLean was a better pitcher. Tonight in Dodger Stadium, Clayton Kershaw, the best Dodger pitcher since Koufax, will start for the National League, and his opponent is Tampa Bay's Shane McClanahan. And the All-Star game is set for tonight. It's not what it used to be, but it's still a major spectacle, and the greatest players in the game, most of them, will be on the field tonight. And Denny McLean, do you still get juiced up all these years later by the Major League All-Star game?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm in Cooperstown. I come up every year, you know, just for memory purposes. My father-in-law, Lou Boudreau, who won MVP in 1948 with the Cleveland Indians, was the youngest manager in the history of baseball at the time. He was 24 when he was managing the Indians. He was inducted in the Hall of Fame in 1970. So, but a lot of memories up here, a lot of stuff hanging that is Lou's stuff. It's really nice, and I'll tell you this. Today's Tuesday. The game I know is tomorrow night, and it's in L.A., but I got news for you. Most of the people are here right now.
All right,
can't believe the traffic.
Actually, the game is tonight, 7 p.m.
Oh, tonight.
Yeah,
I'm
tonight.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
So all these people need to hurry to L.A.
because
I'm in New York.
I remember once when you were pitching, I think it was in 69, you had a dental appointment. I think the game was postponed because it rained, and you had a dental appointment, and you were also a pilot, among many other things,
right.
And you had to fly, I think, fly to Detroit and fly back to pitch in the game, didn't you?
Yeah, because they had done some major, major, major work on my gums. And lo and behold, and they had a 2 or 3 hour session set aside, you know, and they got all these people ready to go. So I flew back the night it was rained out in Washington and got back there and then showed up there at 6:30 in the morning. And actually, my teeth were being cleaned at 41,000 feet above the United States once we got in the plane. And in fact, to get it done, he says, listen, I got another hour to go. I said, well, yeah, you'll do it on the plane. So we got in the airplane, and we all flew over together. We had a great time.
Well, apparently Major League Baseball is going to implement a pitch clock. You have said, you know, that's fooling with some of the great things about the game, and part of it is its mystery.
Yeah.
Is this a good thing? It'll speed up the game, presumably.
No. It's awful. It's awful. I mean, listen, it's, you know, putting a man on second base, somebody says, boy, that's got a little idea now compared to all the things they want to do. I mean, come on. I mean, the game is the game. It's a ball. It's a bat. It's a leadoff. It's a bunt. It's a hit and run. And they just don't, the people in the front office coming up with these silliness is crazy. You know, now they can't shift next year, they say. And the man on second in the extra innings, I think, is out now. Dear God, I hope. But the silliness, let the game play. You know what, I don't know why they think this would draw people or this would make the game faster. It won't. It won't do anything because they're still going to make 3 and 4 pitching changes a game. And does that count in the 20-second rule or the 30-second rule? Hell no, it doesn't. So what do they do? Mm-hmm. I mean, so now they still got a 3.5-hour game. They haven't picked up anything. Let the game play. There's one thing you and I know, and all your fans are listening, that when you have a winner, people come out. If you don't want to spend the money to be in the big leagues and be a big league owner, you don't deserve anything. I mean, you just don't deserve the credit for what you've done. So all these clubs that have been throwing people away, much like one of our clubs, of course, in Detroit, and we made all these moves last year, what did it get us? It got us nothing. So, you know, I don't know. They keep coming up with these. You know, I think half of it is they try to keep baseball in the news. So they fly these things out there, and it's going to be a long time, I think, before it's implemented. Now, that could happen next year, obviously, as like they indicated. But, you know, they're going to get so much rebelling on this that they may drop the whole concept and idea. Maybe, listen, I was really impressed with this commissioner when he was first hired. Now, I mean, I'm sorry. The guy is wanting to be an entertainment manager rather than a baseball commissioner.
All right. Well, we may do away with the umpire calling balls and strikes, too, at some point
soon.
That
would be awful. Who the hell are we going to kick dirt on? The catcher? Come on. I mean, I don't even get it anymore. I mean, can you imagine Billy Martin kicking dirt on a catcher? I mean, I'm sorry. You know, or Earl with the Baltimore Orioles, or even Mail Smith, who did it once or twice. So it's crazy. It's just crazy why they want to do this. You know, it's not an airplane. It's a baseball game.
All right. Well, a listener notes, you're talking about 4 or 5 pitchers a game. Clayton Kershaw, who's the best pitcher in baseball since, for the Dodgers anyway, since Koufax, he's got a 192-86 record. Great record, but in 15 seasons, he has 25 complete games and 15 shutouts. And I'm looking in 2 seasons, 1968 and 69, the man we're talking with, Denny McClain, had 51 complete games and 15 shutouts in 2 seasons. So the game has changed a lot, and pitchers basically 100 pitches and they're down. Do you like that?
No. I'll tell you what I really don't like, and listen, they can make as many changes as they want. That's part of the game to some degree, although they're way overboard now. Guy pitches one inning and he's making $180 million a year. I mean, this is so crazy beyond. Yesterday turned down, I guess it was Soto, the guy who won the home run contest. He turned down a $440 million 15-year contract. Think about that, Jimmy. $440 million, he said no because in 15 years, the $440 million won't be worth $440 million. All of a sudden, this kid's a financial wizard.
He's 23,
Hit your home runs, run your bases, play with your fans, go out there, make all your appearances. And these guys are, for the card shows, these sport shows, God, they're charging $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 to show up for 2 and 3 hours. It's ridiculous. You know, how much isn't $440 enough? You got to charge the public another $50,000 to see your teeth. That makes sense to me.
At 23 years old, he's turned down $440 million for 15 seasons. So he thinks he can get more, and you know the New York Yankees or they'll probably pay him more.
Yeah, the only wish I have is I had been born a little later.
Yeah, if you'd been a generation later, you would be a multimillionaire, but you've done okay, and people...
Yeah, we've done okay.
You know, you talked about in the old days that baseball players, even some of the greatest stars, they were selling cars in the off season.
Absolutely. Guys selling pianos, guys selling insurance. I think we had, at one time at our Detroit club, I think we had more guys selling insurance than any of the insurance companies that have employees. Because they had worked out a program whereby they'd give them a stipend every week of $300-$400. And back in those days, you know, $400-$500 was a lot of money a week per week.
Sure
so
was.
Especially during the winter.
you know, sure especially was. During the winter. Mm-hmm. But it's just a shame where it's gone right now.
Well, to show you how money was scarce in those days, relatively speaking, on the night before he's opening the 1968 World Series, and then it was a 1 o'clock start at Busch Stadium. Denny McClain he's at the piano at the Chase Park Plaza Hotel, and the tip jar is getting rather full. But Denny McClain, you just played and played and played, and you had a pitching assignment against Bob Gibson a few hours after that.
Well, it was fun. I mean, the whole ball club, almost the entire ball club, was in the Chase lot, and I played until 4:30 in the morning. And I had a great time. Everybody got up and sang. Everybody got up and danced. And it was just, you know what I mean? It just felt right. This is the World Series. What are we supposed to do? Go in our room and prayer? That's always helpful. But on our ball club, we didn't have very many guys that prayed a lot. you know, I mean, I won't go any further. But we had a good bunch of guys, just real, real guys. Mm-hmm. And when they got through playing every night, all they wanted was a beer and a sandwich.
All
and
right.
Then they were on their way.
A question from a listener. You mentioned Billy Martin. Was he the last great fighter in Major League Baseball? He was a little wiry guy, but he was tough as nails, wasn't he?
Yeah, man, let me tell you something. He was a gutless little guy, too, because he never, ever got hit first. When he suggested or when he thought he was in danger with anybody, like Dave Boswell, who was his ace pitcher in Minnesota at the time, he and Boswell were arguing over who was going to take the woman out of the bar and take her home that night. And they went outside the bar in Detroit, a very famous bar there, by the way. And lo and behold, Martin said, well, Dave, what do you got to say? And as Dave looked down at the street before he was going to say something, Billy hit him right in the jaw. Didn't break, but he was out. He missed a couple of starts after that. And Boswell blamed all of his after that on that situation because Billy had him intimidated. And how do you hit the manager? You can't hit the manager. You're gone. You know, they'll send you to Timbuktu. But Boswell got knocked out.
I remember.
I wasn't in that bar five times in my life, and that night I was there because Jim Cott was there.
You were there that night. I'll be darned.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah, and that was the scariest thing I ever saw. You know the best thing, best and the worst thing? The police, we must have had 50 cops show up, 50, at least 50. Somebody made a call. And the cops, by the time the cops got through, the people in the crowd, hell no, nobody could remember who hit who.
Well, Denny, it is always great to catch up with you. The man, the myth, the legend, Dennis Dale McClain. 31-6 and 24-9, two Cy Youngs, MVP, and we'll talk soon. Thank you, Denny. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. We're with Marshall John Fisher. His work has appeared in The Atlantic, Harper's, other magazines, and he is a tremendous sports writer. His latest work is 17-0 about the 1972 Miami Dolphins. They went 17-0, the last perfect season for an NFL team, the best team in NFL history, according to the record. And Robert Lipsyte, pretty good sports writer in his own right, says this is the perfect book for that perfect football season filled with imperfect players, cast-offs, and has-beens under a perfectionist coach against the background of a perfect historical storm of Jim Crow, Watergate, and the Vietnam War. A terrific read, writes Mr. Lipsyte. And good morning to you, Marshall John Fisher.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Good to talk with you. Well, Don Shula was the coach. Bill Arnsparger, who later became head coach at LSU, was the defensive coordinator. And it was a team that had a lot of cast-offs, misfits, and tragically, many of them have died with brain injuries suffered during their football years. But the Dolphins of 72, 50 years ago, were something special indeed, weren't they?
They were. They were quite an unusual group. As you say, a lot of them were cast-offs. And the offensive line, for instance, who one of the greatest offensive lines ever, called themselves the Expendables because most of them had been let go by other teams or many of them not drafted. Same thing with the defense, the no-name defense, they were called. They had one big name, Nick Bonacani, who had been an all-star in the AFL for the Boston Patriots. But other than that, they were mostly cast-offs. A lot of their greatest players weren't even drafted, like Manny Fernandez, Doug Swift, so many of them. So they really came together. They were a highly intelligent group of men and very, very motivated. And a lot of that they got from Don Shula, who really was an extremely great motivator of men.
Well, Arnsparger, as I mentioned, was the defensive coordinator, yes. And the defense was a big part of that team. What was it, the 53 defense, wasn't it?
Yes, Bill Arnsparger was really a genius of a defensive coach. He was more like a professor than a coach. He was incredible attention to detail, very soft-spoken, from Kentucky. He often appeared sort of off somewhere distracted by some defensive variation in the back of his mind. And he took these guys and made them into the greatest defense in the league. They were, without question, the best. They gave up the fewest yards, the fewest points. And the 53 defense is something he came up with faced by injuries to his defensive line. And he had the idea to use number 53, Bob Matheson, who had been a lineman up in Cleveland, but not very good at it. And he came down and played as a linebacker for Miami, but they realized he could do both pretty well. And so they had this new scheme whereby he would sometimes line up on the line and rush in. Sometimes he'd line up there and fade back as a linebacker. He could do both, and that was the 53D.
877-217-5757. Tom on Bluebonnet notes something that I think we've talked about on the air, that the Dolphins weren't the biggest team in the league. In fact, Arnsparger, when he came to LSU, that's one of the things he did. He slimmed down his team. Now, today, of course, mm-hmm. bigger is better, but most of those guys were normal-looking fellows, weren't they?
Yes, a lot of the guys were not as big or as fast as you would want normally and in the NFL at that position. Interesting thing about this team, so many people that I either talked to or read quotes from them would say the same thing, which is, I wasn't really that great an athlete, but I made the most of what I had. And of course, this wasn't really true. They were incredible athletes. The emphasis on their athletic talent was not size or speed. They were great athletes, in other ways, and as I say, very smart players. And yeah, Arnsparger took these guys who were, even Bonacani, was always said he was too small and too slow. That's why he wasn't drafted in the NFL. He went in the AFL, but of course now he's in the NFL Hall of Fame because he had heart, he had motivation, he had smarts. And Arnsparger took all these guys, and he made a very, very intelligent defense. One quarterback said, "Oh, the Jets showed me two defensive looks. Miami showed me 22." Mm-hmm. And another opposing coach said, "It seemed like they always knew exactly what we were going to do next."
Tell you what, our phone line with you is a little shaky right now, Marshall. We're going to mm-hmm. try and see if we can get you a better spot. While you do that, I'll talk a little more about the 72 Dolphins. And Robin, let's call him back, see if we can do better. But the Dolphins, of course, were led by Don Francis Shula, who at 33 had become the head coach of the Baltimore Colts and had the unfortunate experience of losing to Joe Willie Namath and the New York Jets in Super Bowl III in Miami, 16-7, January 12, 1969. But then he became coach of the Dolphins in 1970 and immediately turned that team around. And within 3 years, they were in the Super Bowl and undefeated and playing George Allen's Washington Redskins. And Don Shula had the best team in football then, although they did have a competitive game against George Allen, who is another legendary coach. Never won a Super Bowl, but Don Shula lasted an extremely long time as a head coach. He was with the Colts from 1963 to 69, and also with the Dolphins as head coach from 1970 to 1995. So 7 years with the Colts, 26 years with the Dolphins, and his epic team was in 1972. And Don Shula, because of his long tenure in the NFL as coach of Dan Marino and quarterback in 1972 was Bob Greasy, he was named Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year in 1993. Now, a listener notes that the quarterback between Greasy and Marino for the Dolphins was none other than David Woodley, who played football at LSU. And David Woodley led the Dolphins to a Super Bowl as well, which they lost to the Redskins. And we've got Marshall John Fisher back. We're talking about the 72 Dolphins. And I was mentioning, a listener prompted me to reflect on the game that they had against the Redskins. That was a competitive game. And, of course, Garo Yepremian, the kicker, made it even more competitive, didn't he?
Yes. Actually, was that game could have easily been, you know, the final score was 14-7, but the Dolphins had a long touchdown pass to Paul Warfield called back because someone had flinched on the line, and a couple other things happened. It could have been easily 24-0 or something. And as it was, when Garo Yepremian lined up to kick that 37-yard field goal, that would have made it 17-0 to finish off a 17-0 season. And that's what Joe Robbie, the owner, was walking up and down the sideline saying 17-0, 17-0, right before he kicked it. Unfortunately, he kicked it right into his lineman and it bounced back to him. And as everyone knows, he tried to pass instead of falling on it. The ball went straight up in the air. When it came down, he made it even worse by trying to bat it up like a volleyball, straight up back into the air. And finally, Mike Bass of the Redskins took it the other way for a touchdown interception, made it 14-7. But the score makes it look a lot closer than it actually was.
Well, as I mentioned, Don Shula was the mastermind, a devout Roman Catholic. He stated, and I believe him, that he attended Mass every morning. He once considered to become a Catholic priest, but of course he did not. He became a coach and a family guy, and he was an excellent coach, I would say a great coach. And he had been somewhat troubled by his tenure in Baltimore, which of course was the embarrassing loss, included the embarrassing loss to the Jets in Super Bowl III. But I would say he certainly redeemed himself in Miami, Marshall.
Yes, he, as you say, he was the youngest coach in the NFL up in Baltimore, and he was a great coach there. He was considered the best coach, but he had never gone all the way. In 1968, he finally got them to win the NFL championship. But as you say, that was the third year the NFL champs had to play the AFL champs in what they were calling the Super Bowl, Super Bowl III, back before they were the same league. And that was an embarrassing loss to Joe Namath and the Jets. And then his stock dropped after that in Baltimore, and he was happy to come down and take over the expansion Dolphins in only their fifth year when he came down. Mm-hmm. And he took them immediately to the playoffs first year, then to the Super Bowl VI right there in New Orleans against Dallas, where he got killed again. The Cowboys destroyed the Dolphins in that game, and that was really the catalyst for the perfect season, because Shula now was being called the guy who couldn't win the big one. And he just became obsessed with getting back to the Super Bowl and winning it. And he was able to transmit that mania to each and every player. And they, to a man, swore that they would do it.
He won two in a row. But I mentioned, and it is worth discussing, and you certainly reflect on it, but a number of these players had difficulty later in life. Some of them have died tragically. We didn't know about CTE to the extent we know now, but the Dolphins had a bunch of guys who had problems, didn't they?
Yes, of course, they were a unique team on the field, but of course, they were as susceptible as any NFL players to head injuries. And, you know, nobody knew at that time. Even the doctors at that time would kind of brush off the concussions, especially smaller concussions, and say, it's not important. They did not realize the effect of repeated small concussions. And sadly, many of those perfect Dolphins developed CTE. Nick Bonacani, Jim Kick, Earl Morrill, Bill Stanfill all died of it. Several others. Jake Scott eventually succumbed to that. So that you know, is obviously a sad ending for many of them. But others have had very good lives. I mean, they were such an intelligent and motivated group that they had very successful lives, most of them, after football. There's a doctor.
Okay, we do have to roll, unfortunately, but the book is an important one about 1972, 17-0 from Marshall John Fisher. Signature support for our show comes from First Financial Tax and Accounting and Jerry Lane Chevrolet.